Hi, I want to welcome you here. I'm Ellen Lust in the Department of Political Science, and it's my great pleasure today to welcome Hillary Leverett, who we've had the pleasure of having with us this year, teaching in the Jackson Institute, also being just a great colleague and member of the community. So it's a great, great pleasure to welcome you, Hillary. And to give you a bit, for those of you who don't know about her, a bit of background. Hillary graduated from Harvard Law School as well as from Brandeis University, but she's also studied at the American University of Cairo and at Tel Aviv. So she's had a long, two-decade now, history of experience and interaction and expertise on the region. She's a CEO of Strategia, and she's been a news analyst for Al Jazeera English, which I saw her on not long ago, and also a national security expert blogger for the National Journal. Under the George W. Bush administration, she served as the director for Iran, Afghanistan, and Persian Gulf Affairs at the National Security Council. She was the Middle East specialist on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, as well as a political advisor for the Middle East, Central Asian, and African issues for the U.S. mission to the United Nations. From 2001 to 2003, and I think particularly important for the topic that she'll be addressing today, she was one of a small number of U.S. diplomats who was authorized to negotiate with the Iranians over Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda, and Iraq. Before, in the Clinton administration, I'm sorry, she served as a political advisor for the Middle East, Central Asian, and African issues for the U.S. mission as well to the United Nations, as associate director for the Near Eastern Affairs at the National Security Council, and as special assistant to the ambassador at the U.S. Embassy in Cairo. In short, she knows the region well. She knows Iran probably as well or better than others in the States. And we're very, very welcoming of her today. Just to now give a bit of a plug, because I also know and understand, I've just heard this is up on Amazon.com. She and her husband, Flint Leverett, are also the authors of a forthcoming book entitled Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic. And not surprisingly, she's here to talk to us today about Iran, the United States, and the Middle East's changing balance of power. So welcome, Hillary.
I think when we look at the Middle East, many of us are looking at what we see on the ground in the Middle East, and some have called it this momentous change an Arab awakening, really a bottom-up phenomenon, a dramatic manifestation of people power. There are many good reasons to look at what's happening in the Middle East, I think, from this perspective. But for me, as someone who is focused on U.S. foreign policy and international strategy, I'm looking at and interpreting what's going on in the Middle East from a different angle, from another angle that I want to go through with you today. And that is from the breakdown of the U.S.-led political and security order in the Middle East. Essentially, what I see is the potential collapse of U.S. hegemony in the region. To look at the events that we see unfolding on the ground from this angle, it's important to step back. It's important to step back and look at the Middle East really from the end of World War II, as the United States gradually but steadily tried to establish this kind of political and security order in the Middle East that would be favorable to our interests. We gradually and steadily did so, but of course along the way, from the end of World War II to the collapse of the Soviet Union, we were constrained from going for really what I would call all-out hegemony in the Middle East by a major external power at the time, the Soviet Union, and two major internal powers in the region aligned with Moscow. Those were Iraq and Egypt. Fast forward a bit to 1978. Egypt moves decisively out of the Soviet camp, decisively into the pro-American camp in the Middle East, literally signed, sealed, and delivered with the Camp David Accords, with the peace treaty with Israel. There could have been no mistaking the movement of Egypt so decisively into the pro-American camp. And even though a year later we essentially lost Iran from the pro-American camp, Iran did not go to the Soviets. It did not defect to the other side. It was so consumed by its internal political reconstitution and literally defending the country from an invasion coming from Iraq that it was not an effective constrainer on this increasingly U.S.-led political and security order in the Middle East. And by 1991, we essentially took care of the other internal constraint, potential internal constrainer for American hegemony in the Middle East, Iraq, when we dealt Iraq a decisive military defeat after it invaded Kuwait in 1990. So with the subsequent collapse of the Soviet Union, clearly done by the end of 1991, we were essentially unconstrained in the 1990s, going into the 1990s, in both our ability and our determination to consolidate hegemony in the Middle East. And again, by this, I mean really a highly militarized US-led political and security order for the region. Today, what we're seeing is that disappearing right before our eyes. What we're seeing in the Middle East today is a dramatic shift in the regional balance of power, a shift in the relative distribution of power going against the United States and our regional powers, partners, and increasingly going in favor of the Islamic Republic of Iran and its allies. This shift, though, has been going on, I'd say, for probably more than a decade, had been going on for more than a decade. One of the most important consequences that we see with the Arab awakening today, that is unfolding today, is an acceleration and intensification of this shift in the regional balance. And beyond the shift in the relative distribution of power among important regional actors, the very essence of power politics in the Middle East is shifting from hard military power, where the United States has the advantage, to soft power, where the Islamic Republic of Iran has unique advantages. But I want to look with you first at the shift in the relative distribution of power among the important regional actors. Just a decade ago, on the eve of 9/11, on the eve of the terrorist attacks, 9/11 in the United States, the United States had cultivated what I think American policymakers like to refer to as a strong moderate, quote unquote, moderate camp in the Middle East. Now, these so-called moderates were never defined as such because of their internal governance or anything about the way that they dealt with their people. These states were so-called moderates, termed as part of the moderate camp, because they were reasonably well-disposed towards strategic cooperation with the United States, including a negotiated peace settlement with Israel. These states included Egypt, Jordan, the Gulf states, Morocco, Tunisia, and Turkey. On the other side of the Middle East divide were the so-called radicals. And again, called radicals not because of anything that had to do with their internal governance, but because of their position toward US and Israeli policies. That camp, that alliance of groups and countries included the Islamic Republic of Iran, Syria, and at the time, the relatively weak groups of Hezbollah and Hamas. At the time, the other radicals on the scene, Saddam Hussein's Iraq and Gaddafi's Libya, were essentially isolated. Now let's fast forward to the eve of President Obama's inauguration in January 2009. January 2009, you could look out at the region, and I think you would see that as a result of the US invasion of Iraq, the effective collapse of the Middle East peace process, astute politicking and diplomacy by the Islamic Republic of Iran and its allies, because of these issues, the Middle East balance of power, before Obama even stepped foot in the Oval Office, the Middle East balance of power had already shifted significantly against the United States and our regional allies and toward the Islamic Republic of Iran. And again, that's even before he steps foot in the Oval Office in January 2009. I want to go through with you for a moment what that looked like on the ground in the Middle East. Relations between Syria and the Islamic Republic of Iran were increasingly strategic in their quality. They had moved from, I think, largely a tactical alliance in the 1990s to one of real strategic significance for both countries, which have made attempts to pull Syria away from the Islamic Republic of Iran really futile. Turkey, under the AKP, was moving away from its reflexively pro-American stance to chart a genuinely independent political course, foreign policy course, including cultivating a strategically consequential relationship with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Hezbollah and Hamas, legitimated by real electoral successes, had emerged by January 2009 as decisively important political actors in Palestine and Lebanon. Post-Saddam Hussein's Iraq was looking less and less like a potential strategic asset for the United States, and ever more likely that its most important relations, its most important foreign relations, would be with its neighbors, with the Islamic Republic of Iran, Syria, and Turkey. What was driving this shift in the Middle East balance of power? To answer that, I think it's important to look first at the basis for U.S. dominance in the Middle East. U.S. dominance in the Middle East has rested, I think, on two principal factors, capacity and legitimacy. First, regarding capacity, the United States remains uniquely capable of projecting enormous amounts of conventional military power into the Middle East. No one else, not even China, can project this kind of hard conventional military power into the Middle East today. And no one else will be able to do so for years to come. This unique capacity to project massive conventional military power into the Middle East was used, of course, to justify our two interventions with Iraq, in and with Iraq, and today is the precise, verbatim, word-for-word justification that President Obama has used to justify our most recent military intervention in Libya, because the United States has the unique capabilities to do so. But the prolonged, strategically indeterminate U.S. occupations in Afghanistan and Iraq, I think, have underscored the limits of what U.S. military might can accomplish. And I would venture to predict we will see that unfold in Libya as well. Regarding legitimacy, the United States has tried, under successive presidential administrations, under the first George Bush, 41, President Clinton, second George Bush, 43, and now President Obama. We have tried under successive presidential administrations to gain the buy-in of Arab states for what I started out describing to you as this US-led, highly militarized political and security order in the Middle East, what I think political scientists just commonly refer to as hegemony. We've tried to get their buy-in, the Arab states' buy-in for this political and security order, on the grounds that US leadership in the region would bring good things to the Middle East. It would bring the peoples of the region greater security and a resolution of the region's core dispute, the Arab-Israeli conflict. But the facts are the United States has not delivered on these promises. The US military campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq have instead cost us in terms of our perceived legitimacy and the perceived legitimacy of our very purpose of being in the Middle East. Likewise, it has become increasingly clear to Middle East populations that the United States is not going to deliver on Arab-Israeli peace. We're not going to deliver the Israelis to the table, and we're not going to deliver an end to that core conflict. Instead, the United States today is widely seen in the Middle East as enabling an Israeli national security doctrine that requires regional hegemony for Israel, as well as for the United States, but in this context, really for Israel, with the means of permanent occupation and the freedom for Israel to use military force unilaterally and disproportionately. And people throughout the Middle East don't see any end in sight for that. This too has cost the United States in terms of the perceived legitimacy of our very purpose in the Middle East. What I would call these failures did not start with George W. Bush. I don't think they were idiosyncratic or ideologically generated products of just his administration. The drive to consolidate hegemony in the Middle East through the open-ended deployment of large numbers of US military forces on the ground in the Middle East And I think what today really needs to be called the facade of a Middle East peace process, that really starts at the end of the Cold War, at the end of the first Gulf War, under the first president, Bush 41, and it intensified under President Clinton. To a large extent, President George W. Bush 43 carried to their logical conclusion policies that were started under his two immediate predecessors, Bush 41 and Clinton. During the presidential campaign of 2008, then-candidate Obama pledged to change all that. He pledged to change the very foundation of our policies in the Middle East, to put them on a more effective and sustainable trajectory in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in the Arab-Israeli arena, and really in an innovative way, and particularly in a presidential campaign, to try strategic engagement with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Instead, however, my view is that today, President Obama is presiding over what I see as the very demise of the two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He is turning the United States into a quasi-permanent occupying power in Afghanistan by surging additional troops into that country with no strategy for a political settlement there. And he has discredited engagement as a strategy for dealing with Iran and for others by saying he tried but failed to reach out to the Islamic Republic of Iran, when I think the record shows that he didn't seriously even try. This dynamic is playing out today with Libya as well. The dominant image is of a Gaddafi who is irrational and in some ways just downright evil. But the facts are that the United States negotiated successfully with this same Muammar Gaddafi. We negotiated with him on high priority issues like weapons of mass destruction and links to terrorist groups. And the record shows that in those negotiations, Gaddafi could act rationally in US interests in a way that benefited the United States in very real, tangible ways. But here again, what President Obama did when faced with a choice is that he foreclosed any negotiations with Gaddafi with Libya, just as effectively as he has foreclosed negotiations with the Islamic Republic of Iran. He did so with Gaddafi on March 3rd by declaring that Gaddafi had lost all legitimacy and had to go. From that moment on, from March 3rd on, we were on a trajectory for military conflict with Libya. It was just a matter of when. Imagine for a moment if Nixon or Kissinger had said these things about China's Chairman Mao in the late 1960s or early 1970s. Where would US-China relations be today? What would America's position in Asia be like today if we had adopted that kind of policy? This, in large part, I think, is why in the Middle East, the balance of power is shifting even further away from the United States on Obama's watch, and why it's shifting further away from the United States and increasingly toward the Islamic Republic of Iran that has a better narrative for populations in the Middle East. What the Islamic Republic of Iran has done all this time is continue to deepen its alliances with Syria, with Turkey, expand its influence with groups and populations in Iraq, in Lebanon, and Palestine. Its allies in these areas have consolidated their standing in their regional arenas as the most influential political actors in the region. That's how the Islamic Republic of Iran is shifting the balance of power on their side in their favor. And Obama's standing by for the most part, of course, with the exception of Libya, but he's standing by otherwise as new openings develop for the Islamic Republic of Iran to reset the regional balance of power emerging, to reset it in places like Bahrain and perhaps even Egypt, Tunisia, Yemen, and other places. As I just flagged, I think the one place where he's not stood by is in Libya, where, of course, President Obama has ordered US military intervention in what may be characterized as a civil war on the ground there, for the United States to be on one side, on the side of the rebels, against the Libyan government and its supporters. I think President Obama tonight will try to make a case that this is because of a sober analysis of on-the-ground conditions. I think we should really challenge that as Americans. I don't think that President Obama will be able to tell the American people, for example, how many civilians Gaddafi's forces have killed in this round of protests. I don't even think he'll be able to give a rough estimate. The estimates vary dramatically. I think President Obama will refer to what might have happened in Benghazi if we didn't intervene militarily. But when he does that, he will ignore the record of how Gaddafi has responded to past uprisings in Libya, including in the Benghazi region. Of course, any loss of life is terrible, but those interventions did not lead to the deaths of tens of thousands of people and did not lead to the mass migration of Libyans to Egypt, which is what Secretary Clinton claimed yesterday when she was on the Sunday morning shows. What this will effectively define, I think, for President Obama, and what he will, I think, effectively define this evening, is a doctrine of preventive humanitarian intervention. It will be a very close analog, if not just a direct supplement, to President Bush 43's endorsement of preventive war. So that means the United States will now have preventive war as its strategy, not just to deal with weapons of mass destruction, links to Al-Qaeda, but now we'll have this component of what if there might be a humanitarian problem, disaster, or I think as Secretary Clinton put it yesterday, the potential for instability. From this perspective, I think that Obama's course is at best strategically incoherent. And I think the real motive really is desperation. Desperation to reverse perceptions that U.S. influence in the United States is now in free fall. I think that perception is well-founded, that U.S. influence in the Middle East now is in free fall. Because the facts are what they are. All of the Middle Eastern regimes that have been seriously challenged by sustained popular unrest are either close American allies, Bahrain, Egypt, Tunisia, and Yemen, or former rogue states that made complete deals to go into the pro-American camp, like Libya. That is the pattern. I don't think that what we're seeing happening in Syria fundamentally alters this pattern. At this point, the manifestations of popular unrest that we've seen in Syria are not large enough or broad-based enough to pose a real threat to the government. That might change, but Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria's assiduous cultivation of an independent foreign policy line that grounds popular perceptions among Syrians that their country is not subordinate to the United States, Israel, or any other outside power, gives Bashar al-Assad important political resources he can draw on to help manage the challenge he faces. That is something that is not available to these other countries where we see sustained popular unrest. It makes me even more strongly persuaded that Western speculation that the wave of popular unrest we've seen throughout the Middle East that has literally overwhelmed the pro-American Arab regimes there, it makes me very, very speculative that that kind of unrest could really seize and take hold of and overthrow the government in the Islamic Republic of Iran. I think that is wishful thinking. Why is this? I've taken a lot of criticism for this view. But since literally the day after the Islamic Republic of Iran's presidential elections in June 2009, I have argued that the Iranian opposition Green Movement does not represent anything close to a majority of Iranian society inside Iran, and that the majority of Iranians inside Iran continue to support the idea of an Islamic Republic there. And today, I think the opposition Green Movement in Iran represents an even smaller portion of Iranian society than it did in the summer of 2009, when it had an immediate grievance around which to rally protest. Moreover, efforts to restart protests in the Islamic Republic of Iran have taken place at what I think most Iranians inside Iran see as their moment in the Middle East. This is the time when the regional balance of favor is shifting, the regional balance of power is shifting in their favor. It's their movement. That decreases the amount of political space available for the Green Movement to put out its message. And again, I think the popular sense of independence is really important to these dynamics. The overwhelming majority of Iranians, even those who want the Islamic Republic of Iran to evolve in ways very different from its current state, who want to see very significant reforms in the Islamic Republic, even among those Iranians, the vast majority, I think, see the Islamic Republic of Iran as their system, their indigenously created system, warts and all. This is a very important part of why the Islamic Republic, in my view, has defied conventional wisdom and not only survived throughout the past 30 years of repeated predictions that it will implode and collapse, not only survived those predictions, but strengthened to the extent that the Islamic Republic of Iran can now balance effectively against the United States in what is now a competition for influence in the Middle East. So I come back to my point that the relative distribution of power in the Middle East is shifting. It is shifting away from the United States and our allies and increasingly to the Islamic Republic and its partners in the resistance camp. In this context, Iranian policymakers, I think, are confident, and I think with good reason, that any government in the Arab world which becomes at all more representative of its people's values, beliefs, concerns, preferences, and interests, any government in the Arab world that becomes more representative of that will become less enthusiastic about strategic cooperation with the United States and Israel. And that is a net plus for the Islamic Republic of Iran. As long as the current regimes in the Middle East are not replaced by stridently Sunni Salafi-dominated Islamist orders, like we see in some ways in Saudi Arabia or the Taliban in Afghanistan, as long as these regimes don't turn into those kinds of Islamist political orders, the Arab governments that emerge from the present turmoil will follow, I think, an independent foreign policy line. And on the whole, that will create greater receptivity to the Islamic Republic of Iran's message of independence and resistance. This message does not just apply to Shiite Muslims. Public opinion polls and just the experience of spending time on the ground in these societies in the Middle East indicate that the message of resistance resonates throughout the region and has tremendous appeal, not just to Shia, but on the Sunni Arab street. And Iran calculates that this will work in its favor. Iran doesn't have to meddle in regional politics. The Islamic Republic of Iran can sit on its hands and reap these benefits. The regional balance of power is also shifting at another very important level. It is shifting in the very essence of Middle East power politics. On this level, the critical point is that the balance of power in the Middle East is becoming relatively less defined by hard military capabilities and quantifiable economic indicators, and relatively more defined in terms of a balance of influence in the Middle East. Here it's important to discuss soft power. Soft power, of course, famously defined by Harvard University's Joseph Nye as the capacity of getting others to want what you want, contrasted with the ability to coerce others through the exercise of hard military and/or economic power. One of the most remarkable things about the shift in the Middle East balance of power over the last decade, away from the United States and our allies, and increasingly in favor of the Islamic Republic of Iran and its partners, is that this shift
has had virtually nothing to do with military capabilities or other forms of hard power. It's quite astounding. It's very much about soft power and the fact that the Islamic Republic of Iran has picked winners, including regional publics, rather than losers as its political allies in key regional theaters throughout the Middle East. To do this, Iran has cultivated an expanding reservoir of soft power. Its soft power is derived from its support for resistance movements on the front lines of the Arab-Israeli conflict, and in its defiance, its very defiance of the United States and other Western powers over the nuclear issue. For the last decade or so, and I would say especially since President Ahmadinejad's initial election to the presidency in 2005, the Islamic Republic of Iran has worked to maximize the strategic leverage it derives from its soft power edge. In particular, the Islamic Republic of Iran has used its standing as the de facto leader of the Middle East resistance bloc to mobilize regional publics' most intensely felt grievances, including those grievances against the United States and Israel and the region's pro-Western regimes. Many Western analysts dismiss the significance of this soft power, particularly in the coldly competitive venue of Middle Eastern power politics. But the kind of soft power that the Islamic Republic has been able to generate and cultivate has had real-world impact. Former National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski, I think, has written with particular insight about something here, what he describes as a global political awakening in which nearly universal access to radio, TV, the internet is creating a community of shared resentments and envy that transcends sovereign borders. In the Middle East and other regions that are scarred by memories of colonial and imperial domination, this is generating a yearning for human dignity and cultural respect among local populations. Consequently, these same populations, disliking of the status quo, can be mobilized against those whom they perceive as self-interestingly preserving the status quo. The quintessential example of this is the United States and its relationship with President Mubarak in Egypt. Iranian policymakers, even before Brzezinski made his observation, I think fundamentally grasped the potential for Middle Eastern populations mobilized against the status quo to challenge existing regimes, to challenge a regional order dominated by the United States, and to challenge a regional balance of power tilted very significantly against the Islamic Republic of Iran. What they developed was a real strategy. What the Iranian strategists developed was a real strategy. One might even say grand strategy. But as Americans, we have invested so much mental energy and political capital in demonizing the Islamic Republic of Iran that we haven't been able to recognize the extent and the amount of what they're accomplishing. In strategic terms, the Islamic Republic is using through its narrative, not its meddling, but its narrative, it is using the political awakening of Middle Eastern publics to alter the very nature of power politics in the region. More specifically, the Islamic Republic of Iran is working to transform the Middle East's traditional balance of power, to transform this traditional balance of power framework defined by conventional military capabilities and other hard power assets in which the Islamic Republic of Iran is deficient. They're trying to transform that into a balance of influence defined by aspects of soft power in which the Islamic Republic of Iran has some very unique advantages. This transformation is bolstering the Islamic Republic of Iran's ability to shape strategic outcomes in the Middle East. The U.S. faces some very serious challenges there. Our strategic position, as I said from the onset, in this vital world, part of the world, is eroding before our eyes. to repair and restore our standing and strategic leadership in the Middle East, we will have to reacquire two skills at which we have been sorely out of practice. One is the capacity to legitimate our leadership in the Middle East by actually delivering important benefits to our partners there, rather than being a contributor to the Middle East's problems. The second skill we need to reacquire, that we will need to really relearn, I think, is the art of classical diplomacy, meaning the art of managing a regional balance through relationships with the full range of important actors, cutting across multiple axes of geopolitical alignment. This will mean an end to trying to isolate and contain players that don't go along with our current understanding or view of what is pro-American or anti-American in the region. It will mean developing real strategic relations with each of the major powers. And that means starting the hard work of a rapprochement with the Islamic Republic of Iran, just as Nixon and Kissinger did with the People's Republic of China in the early 1970s. Thank you very much for your attention. I'd be happy to have a discussion. Any questions or please? I think when we talk about the GCC, it's of course a critical part of the Middle East. When we talk about the GCC, the most important, vital member of that grouping is Saudi Arabia. We have a long strategic partnership with Saudi Arabia that even if the Saudis encounter protests, which they haven't on a sustained basis through the Arab Awakening, even if they do, I think that the relationship with Saudi Arabia will remain a strategic one in America's vital interests. But the way that we can more effectively manage that relationship, both for our own interests and I think for the Saudis, is to be able to have a strategy where we have a relationship with all of the players in the region. It's dysfunctional at this point to have a relationship just with the Saudis and not with the other major great power across the Gulf. That means that it's constantly the US versus the Saudis in the push and pull of politics and diplomacy. Whereas if we had the relationship with Iran, as we did in the 1970s and before, the Iranians and the Saudis could balance each other in the region. And we could take more of the position of the offshore balancer, only coming into the region when there really is a crisis that threatens American vital interests. For the remainder of the time, the great powers in the region, principally Saudi Arabia and Iran, but also traditionally Iraq, Turkey, Egypt, and probably I would put Israel in this category, if they could be balancing each other in the region, we could be offshore. But our policy, I think our dysfunctional policy of essentially taking out and trying to contain some of these major powers makes us directly an onshore balancer, makes us a very important, if not really hegemonic power in the region, where we are effectively, and we certainly are with troops on the ground, there to balance the other players. And that means they're always going to be doing something against us rather than busy doing something against each other or trying to work out things more constructively with each other. I think the best way that we can have a really strategic, constructive relationship with Saudi Arabia is to balance it with a strategic, constructive relationship with Iran and let them balance each other. I think that is really the way that you get stability and as much peace as possible in the region. Please. Thank you. That's also a very good question. I look at the Iraq intervention as an intervention of two parts. And the first part was in 1991, legitimated then by a UN mandate and an Arab League mandate and Arab participation, vital Arab participation. We launched the entire operation from Saudi Arabia, and we continued to enforce the no-fly zone over Iraq for 12 years from Saudi Arabia with active, heavy Saudi involvement. I don't see the 2003 intervention as that deviating from the initial intervention. So to me, when I look at the two, and I think if you look at it historically and what the consequences have been, they are pretty similar. When you hear people today saying, well, the Libya intervention is new and different, both because it has a UN Security Council mandate and because it has Arab participation, to me, it is really ahistoric, because we did have that for Iraq. We tend not to look at it at what we had for Iraq, because I think we were so focused on the attempt, potentially, maybe you could characterize it this way, of the George W. Bush administration to turn back to Iraq when it should have been focused on Al-Qaeda. But that's really a political battle from here in the United States. I don't think it really is about the region. If you look at the intervention for Iraq, I think it really is one that you could just say unfolds in two or three parts. The 1990-91 intervention, the subsequent no-fly zone for 12 years, and then the 2003 intervention to finish it off. So if you look at it that way, I think the narratives are pretty similar. And I think that if you look at it that way, the lesson that you could take from it is that we will not escape the blowback and the consequences that we had from the Iraq intervention, both in terms of regional publics turning against it, regional governments turning against it. And I think you saw that in an almost comical way, how the Arab League Secretary General, Amr Moussa, couldn't even sustain 24 hours of agreement before coming back and saying, well, that's not exactly what he agreed to. It's amazing when you look at what happened in the Arab League deliberations over Libya. Typically, the Arab League puts out a statement of what they agreed at their meetings. They didn't put one out this time. We don't know who agreed to what. It's quite striking, and I think we will see, similar to the Iraq intervention, people having second thoughts both among regional publics and among regional leaderships. We've been, in a sense, blinded by that because we've separated the Iraq interventions. But I think we'll see that come back, and I think we'll end up paying some pretty severe consequences. Please, Ellen. Mm-hmm.
And I'd also like to hear just a little bit more about Syria, maybe, because I'd like to hear.
Yes.
You're essentially sort of, your argument is that Syria is not likely to see much change and sort of moves on from there. But I'm
Yeah.
Or is it sort of the resistance factor, right? This is about sort of, you know, kind of a sectarianism versus the sort of the model of Iran and resistance. And I'm just wondering which way you think Syria and what it would do for those relations if you actually did see change in Syria.
Yeah, two very important, very, very important questions. I think the way it's been posited to deliver on Libya, to deliver essentially on behalf of the people, not just for ourselves in terms of oil or Israel, is a really, really important one, something that's resonating throughout the region. But to deliver doesn't necessarily mean, and I think actually just does not mean, delivering militarily. I think that's a false option. We tried it with Iraq, and we were encouraged, very significantly encouraged, to deliver on Iraq by many of our Arab allies, not just in the Gulf, but by Egypt. Hosni Mubarak was pleading with us to deliver on Iraq at the time. Saudi Arabia was pleading with us to deliver on Iraq at the time. But it didn't work. That kind of military intervention isn't really delivering on behalf of the people in the region. The consequences, the blowback, the inevitable on-the-ground occupation that the United States has to adopt, has to pursue with no end in sight, is not in our interest and it's not in their interests. So I think that's constantly put out as an option for the United States, but it's a really, really false one, and I think one that has done real damage. The one that's never put out, and this gets to one of the other points I tried to lay out, one we never entertain because we've demonized these various players that we see as against the American-led political and security order. So whenever they come up, they get demonized, whether it's Iraq under Saddam Hussein in 1990, whose troops go into Iraq to pull babies out of the incubators and steal the incubators. Of course, a lot of these stories never are true. They're recanted after the fact. Of course, Iraq having nuclear weapons, recanted after the fact. The demonization that happens with Iran, which makes it impossible for us to negotiate with a Hitler-like Ahmadinejad bent on being history's first suicide nation. This demonization that I think has very little grounding in reality comes up again with Gaddafi. And so it puts us into this false paradigm where it's either we intervene militarily on behalf of the population or we have no choice. But we have a choice. We could negotiate. Because we've demonized the player that is then deemed impossible to bring into the pro-American camp, we can't negotiate with them. And that's why I think that President Obama's March 3rd statement that Gaddafi had lost all legitimacy and had to go was a really fatal strategic error, because it meant that we couldn't negotiate with him. Now, why couldn't we negotiate with him? Okay, he may not be the most pleasant person to negotiate with, but we have a track record of negotiating with him over really important, complicated, divisive, hard issues. Negotiating over nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction is a really hard, often tedious process that involved a lot of different agencies on our side and on the Libyan side. It wasn't just something where Gaddafi sat at the table and raised his hand up or down whether something could go forward. Disengaging Libya from the web of ties it had to groups that we designate as terrorist organizations was tremendous work. This was a multi-year process where the Libyans were fully engaged and delivered every single thing we wanted at the end, every single thing. So at the outbreak of this current conflict with Gaddafi, one of the first things that Gaddafi wants to do, says himself, says through his son and other envoys, he wants the United Nations, the Security Council, to send monitors into Libya to do a fact-finding mission. We laugh it off. This is just propaganda. He just wants to, you know, use UN monitors to have kind of this fake show of an ideal situation in Libya. He sends envoys to Europe to negotiate with Europeans, with us. We refuse to meet with the envoys because, again, we don't want to be we don't want to stall for time and let people be killed on the massacred on the ground while we're sipping our tea and crumpets and negotiating. That's the mindset that prevents us from negotiating. But if we actually did negotiate with Gaddafi, as we had previously, I think there is no reason to think, based on the historical record of Gaddafi's behavior, that we couldn't have come to negotiate some negotiated settlement. Now, does that mean that Gaddafi would have been forced from office? Maybe not. Does it mean that he could have had some sort of internal exile or power sharing? May have been hard, but it may have been possible. And I think we would have saved an enormous number of lives that way than through this false paradigm that we can intervene on the people's behalf. So
what I think is critically important is for us to really be looking at how we demonize the other player, so much so that we make negotiation impossible. And what's dramatic in this situation is that we actually, because Bahrain is considered pro-American and would, quote unquote, listen to us, that's exactly what Secretary Clinton said, well, King Hamad listened to us, they could have dialogue. Even though they had also used helicopters to shoot at their people. They had also killed people, open fire with live ammunition. Done a lot of the same things that the Libyans did. But because they would, quote unquote, listen to us, they're in the pro-American camp, they get dialogue. Libya's not, they get regime change. We may see, you know, some sort of victory in this, where there may be, you know, some kind of statue like there was in 2003 that U.S. soldiers or other soldiers take down in some square in Libya of Gaddafi. But I think it will be really, really short-lived, and the consequences could be just as bad as they have been from Iraq. So to me, it's really, really problematic to posit the military intervention as an option, where I think it has some real drawbacks, when it's almost unimaginable for Americans to think about negotiating. So in the last, kind of the last part where I tried to draw out our options, delivering on Arab-Israeli peace would be ideal. I believe in that very strongly. But short of the ideal, we can deliver in some other ways. Or we could let others deliver. You know, Turkey and Venezuela, and again, we demonize Venezuela, so that becomes problematic, but at least Turkey have stepped forward as possible mediators to what's going on in Libya. We have, you know, we've dismissed those options in the past, not just with Libya, but with Iran. Last May, the Turks and the Brazilians came forward to negotiate a resolution with Iran over the nuclear issue. They succeeded. They came up with a very good negotiated document. We dismissed it out of hand. That's something that I think has to fundamentally change, and that's what I'm really talking about in terms of delivering. Delivering an Arab-Israeli peace would be ideal, I think is necessary, but short of that, we can deliver in some other areas. So I think it is really important and needs to be unpacked, needs to be unpacked more. On Syria, it's tough to talk to one of the world's leading experts on Syria, two of the world's leading experts sitting right here, not only of course, has Ellen Less done groundbreaking research there, speaks fluent Syrian Arabic, but the person sitting next to her has also written a book about Syria, so it's a little tough to speak about Syria in that context, but I will anyway. Things could change in Syria, but what I think is important is that Bashar al-Assad has a political resource that some of his fellow heads of state do not have to draw on. And that is the political resource of having developed, carried on his father's legacy of developing this really independent state in Syria and keeping Syria together in a unified secular way when it has so many internal fissures and sectarian divisions. I think that many people in Syria, I think the majority, not everybody, but the majority, I think, in Syria, do not want the country to be basically at war in itself among the various sects. I think that really plays in Bashar al-Assad's favor. And I think you saw the counter demonstrations in Damascus in favor of Bashar al-Assad, testament to the amount of investment people have in the Syrian state. Now, when I've met with Bashar al-Assad for various research interviews, he has really talked about the motivating cause for his politics being to maintain Syria as a secular, unified state. I think that has tremendous resonance, not only for his ethnic group, for the Alawi, certainly for the Christians in Syria, and I think for a significant number of the Sunni elite. Now, that's not going to be everybody in Syria. There certainly is a history in Syria dating back many, many decades of a very active Islamist current in various areas of the country. And given the opportunity, and particularly in a Facebook generation, they have, I think, an opportunity to make their voice heard. I don't think it will be a majority of the country, and I think there is enough of this vested interest that Bashar al-Assad could draw from. Now, I don't think he has some of the potential safety valves that maybe some others do, to open the politics more, If he gives everybody, you know, the one man, one vote principle, that's not necessarily going to be in his favor. I don't think political reform is something that's going to help solve his problem. But if he can push the narrative of being uniquely capable of leading the state to stay unified and not and basically non-sectarian in a very, very troubled universe, in a very, very troubled neighborhood, I think that's something that has really served him well. And we've seen him come back, like his father, we've seen both of them really severely tested. You know, in 2005, Bashar al-Assad was, I think, the laughingstock of the region and in Washington. He was seen in Washington as not just bad, but not intelligent. People commonly referred to him as the evil moron in Washington. And he was quite isolated in the region. But he fought back from that isolation with, I think, this political drive of Syria as an independent, strategic, important player. He was able to fight back and really reverse that isolation so that today he has these really strategically consequential relationships, not just with Iran, but with Turkey. I think he's really fought back in Lebanon. He's essentially got the Israelis on his side. I mean, you know, you read Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, they're talking about how bad it would be if Bashar al-Assad fell. I mean, this is quite a turn of events for him. And similarly, his father, you know, his father didn't really become known as the Lion of Damascus until both he put down the internal challenge in Hama and he really pushed back on the Israelis and the Americans in Lebanon. Now, maybe Bashar al-Assad will need to do that in reverse. First, he pushes back on the United States and the French in international politics. And second, he deals with the internal challenge. I hope for Syrians that he can deal with the internal challenge in a less violent way. And I think he can, but it will be a challenge, but I think he does have the political resources to come through. But again, it's a challenge. I just don't think that he's not facing the overwhelming challenge and the sustained challenge and the massive challenge that the other state, the pro-American states have taken. And I think that's in particular because he doesn't have to deal with the problem of having taken a pro-American line that was against the perceived interests of his people. Please.
Why did England and France seem to be very aggressive in this situation?
That is a $64 million question. And it's, you know, particularly for France, of course, it's a complete reversal to where they were, you know, just less than a decade ago. It is a complete reversal. I think some people ascribe it to the personal politics of Sarkozy. Others, I think, ascribe it to kind of the dynamics of the European Union having to remain relevant in an international political system where they are becoming both less relevant, less economically powerful, and for themselves, in themselves, less cohesive. That before the invasion of Iraq, Europe was really on its way to not only a strong currency, a very strong and dominant economy, but was really on its way towards powerful political integration. You know, that in the past 5 years has come crashing down for the Europeans. And I think, unfortunately, we've seen in European history that often has them turn outward to consolidate some of their political and economic influence beyond their borders. But it still, to me, is a $64 million question. They've done it today with Libya, but they even started really doing it with Iran during the 2008 presidential campaign in this country for the presidency. It was quite striking that during the campaign, when then-candidate Obama put out the idea of strategic engagement with the Islamic Republic of Iran, British and French diplomats from their embassies in Washington met with Obama aides to say, "What are you doing? Why are you reaching out to Iran? This isn't going to be good. This is counterproductive. We need to be standing together as one cohesive political alignment against Iran." They were really interfering in an American political campaign in a way that I don't think we've seen for a very, very long time. So I don't think it's a sudden turn with Libya, but it's certainly a very dramatic turn with Libya. It remains to be seen to me whether President Obama can sell their concerns as a reason for the Americans to act in yet another military intervention in a Muslim country. I think Obama will try to make that case tonight. I remain to be convinced. But why that dynamic is happening, I think some of it has to do with their political and economic concerns inside Europe, but it really is a $64 million question. Please, in the back.
I wonder how the U.S. can promote simply human rights in the region.
Human rights is, I think, a very important issue. Of course, we want, and certainly as an American, I would like human rights in my country to be impeccably respected, and I would like that every place else in the world. And I don't consider myself to really be a relativist, but I do consider myself to be a realist and to look at really situations on the ground as they are. And let me take one example. In the Islamic Republic of Iran, I think it is typically caricatured as a misogynist political order that is very oppressive toward women. But if you look at just the education statistics, and if you go, when you go to the Islamic Republic of Iran and you look at women and girls in school, it's quite a dramatic story. The number of women and girls that have been educated percentage-wise in the population under the Islamic Republic of Iran compared to under the Shah, when you had a clearly pro-American political order, what was looked like on the outside as a liberal political order where women didn't have to go with a head covering, the number of women and then the percentage of women in their among women in the population was relatively low compared to what it is today. And one of the reasons is that women now who have to wear the hijab, who have to be covered, wear the chador, their families, particularly outside of North Tehran, are much more willing to allow those girls to go to school, to allow those girls and then women to go to university. So today, when you go to the University of Tehran, the majority of the faculty members and students, the majority of students in the Faculty of Medicine are women. Many of the department heads at the University of Tehran are women. It's really quite astounding to see. That is not something that you would have seen in the 1970s in Iran. So this idea that women are oppressed because of the certain lens that we have on it, in some cases that's very true. But in some cases it really defies conventional wisdom, because sometimes having the traditional veneer of something we as Americans see as oppressive is not necessarily oppressive in some ways that really, really matter. And I think education is one of those things that really, really matters to the advancement of women, for women's opportunities, and for the family. Because if an educated mother, if a mother is educated, I think that not only helps her in her marriage, helps her in the family, and helps her children. And this is something that I think the Islamic Republic of Iran, for all of its flaws, and I'm not here to say that it's any kind of perfect society, I think it has some very significant flaws. But taking this issue of women, I think it is often used as a wedge issue. But when you look at those education statistics, I think it tells a very, very different story. And well, to me, everything, all credit goes to women in almost every area. I tell that to my husband every day. And absolutely, I mean, the determination for women and girls to go to school and to learn is absolutely 100% their right to own that success for themselves. But it's something that every woman, I think, does in partnership as part of a family. And if they're in a family that's not going to let them go to school because they're concerned about their safety, whether that's right or wrong, that's a problem. And if that problem can be addressed by them wearing the hijab or the chador, that's something that I personally am not going to be against. I'm not going to stand in their way. So I just think it's a situation where you have to look at each country and see what they are, and then see what is it possible for the United States to do or to not do. So for example, looking at Afghanistan, I think the idea that we should send U.S. troops into Afghanistan to help the women there is a very, very problematic issue. Very, very problematic. To force the Afghans to change some of their cultural and traditional ways of dealing with women, I think, first of all, is really questionable whether it can happen. And I think the idea that they're going to want to do it, again, this is the soft power importance, I think, of Joseph Nye's concept, that they're going to want to do this on behalf of their women and girls because they're forced to do so, you know, from a bayonet on a tank, is really, I think, is nonsensical. And if you look at how it's played out on the ground, you know, I would encourage people to read in this month's is it Mother Jones or Rolling Stone magazine? In Rolling Stone magazine, there's a really very important article about yet again U.S. troops dealing with the civilian population in a horrendous, horrendous way. And the idea that that's somehow going to produce benefits for women, I don't think makes sense. And we shouldn't really, we shouldn't have any blinders on. You know, one of the big things that the United States did in terms of dealing with women on the ground was we gave Viagra to Afghan warlords. That's not gonna help women on the ground in Afghanistan. So in that area in particular, I think we should not be engaged. And we should let different societies, different regions develop their own ways at their own pace. And we should promote programs. We should promote education. We should promote the World Health Organization, vaccines, health for the population. And you know that that will get to women as it gets to women. Please. I think that's also a really good question. When I said that they could sit on their hands and benefit, reap the benefits of what's happening in the region, it doesn't mean that they're not involved. I think they have a really powerful narrative that makes them absolutely involved in the dynamics of the region and is helping to really shift the balance of power in this soft power way to their in a way that is to their advantage. What it means is that it doesn't, they're not doing it by giving, you know, a rocket to Hamas here or, you know, 10 rockets to Hezbollah there or $1 million to this person or that person. It means that they're really developing this soft strategy of using a narrative that appeals to populations beyond their borders. Now, here I think it's really important, and not to give a plug for our book, but I think it is really important to look at realistically the national security strategy of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Typically, Western analysts have looked at Iran's national security strategy, and they anchor it from the Shah's time, and they kind of come to today without that much difference. Under the Shah, I think Iran had some real liabilities. It is largely a Shiite country and not Arab. Those two pieces of Iran's composition, I think, made it very, very difficult for the Shah to really project any kind of soft power influence beyond Iran's borders. And therefore, the Shah had to really adopt more hard power, you know, more hard power levers to deal with other states. And that's one part why he was able to develop and cultivate a relationship with Israel, because it was much more of a hard power relationship. What the Islamic Republic of Iran has going for it, which we, I think, all too easily dismiss, is that it is able to use its soft power to appeal beyond its Shia identity, beyond its Persian identity, to really get at the issues that Muslims throughout the Middle East, that Arabs throughout the Middle East, really care about. Now, in part, it's hard for us to see it because, in part, it's in language that many Americans find offensive. It deals with Israel, it deals with the Holocaust, it deals with 9/11, it deals with issues that we are just reflexively very, very concerned about. So it's really hard for us to hear. But in the Middle East, particularly with Ahmadinejad, but I think even going back throughout the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran, we've seen this steadily increase. They are able to use this soft power, this narrative of championing justice, independence, Palestine, being against the United States. They're able to really champion in a way that has resonance beyond their Shia and Persian identities. And I think that in part has really given the Islamic Republic this soft power edge that was not available to the Shah, and why the Shah had to really pursue much more of a hard power strategy. Please. I think it does take a great president. And I think it does take a great Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. and I hate to say this because I am a Harvard-educated lawyer, but one of the great pleasures and benefits of being at Yale, in addition to kind of working on these issues much more from a political perspective, political science perspective, really, over the years, has been an understanding of how important this kind of rigorous academic grounding in political science and international relations is. We really need a strategist in the White House. We don't need a lawyer. Whether that lawyer is a Republican lawyer or a Democratic lawyer, Democratic Party lawyer, they just see the issues and see the region very, very differently. I mean, you hear President Obama, as another Harvard-trained lawyer, saying that, you know, we had a good process. He heard this person's view and that person's view, and he came to this decision as if he's some Solomon-like judge. But that's not a strategist. He might be fair, he may be inclusive, he may have a variety of different views at the table, but that's not a strategist. And his national security advisor is the same way. And we had that under Clinton. I think it's a serious problem that we've really invested our foreign policy strategy to lawyers. And again, I say that against my own interest, but I think there is really a different analytic approach. Now, you could have, I think, a strategist who's not really a great strategist. And I would have some criticisms of some American secretaries of states and national security advisors and presidents who were not lawyers and were poor strategists. But I do think one of the things that's necessary is this really rigorous study, either in academia or just on their own at least, a really rigorous study of international relations and great power politics. And to come from that with a real strategy, understanding of what U.S. interests are, how they can be achieved, what the limits are for what we can achieve. That is crucial, and I think that's something that, of course, Kissinger is the embodiment of, and in what, you know, there are many negatives of what Kissinger did, many problems with what he did, but I think the overall strategic approach that he put on the table enabled him to carry out one of the greatest diplomatic accomplishments in American history, the U.S. opening to China. I cannot see now, with the current constellation of policymakers we have, any one of them really thinking that through and understanding how necessary that is with the Islamic Republic of Iran. But it is absolutely necessary, and if, you know, I have to make this argument, and my husband has to make this argument, and we have to, you know, write 10 books about it, I think we'll do that, because it really is critically important for the United States, not only to restore our credibility and our standing in the Middle East, but that is so important for our global standing. We will not be a global power if we do not have the balance of power right in the Middle East in our favor. That is just a requirement for our global standing. And I think there's just too much at stake. But unfortunately, I think it does require people in the White House to really be strategists, foreign policy strategists. Please. Well, I would focus really on some of the comments that I had at the end of my talk, that I think we should really be looking at delivering benefits, being seen as the purveyor of benefits of good in the region, and then that plays out in different ways. That could play out trying to deliver a resolution of the region's core conflict, the Arab-Israeli conflict. That could play out, as it has over the decades, in providing security for the region. That could play out in terms of providing human security on the ground through negotiation with governments and publics. It could play out in a variety of ways, but I think the overarching strategy is to be delivering something good for people on the ground rather than being perceived as part of the problem that regional governments have to support us against their people. Which essentially is what they have to do now, whether it's in helping us with our rendition program, to get to basically take Arab citizens anywhere in the world to bring back to their country to be tortured for information for the United States to use. That's not something that is seen as a good on the ground in the Middle East. It's not, you know, for regional governments to have to work with us, with the Israelis, to continue the siege of a civilian population in Gaza. That's not perceived as a good on the ground in the region. We would need to change some of those things to be perceived as not being a problem, not being part of a problem for Arab publics, and to do something to replace that's something good, that they can see as a good. That would help, I think, rehabilitate our legitimacy, the legitimacy of our purpose in the region, to deliver in some way on those benefits. And the other critical piece of the strategy would be to balance, to allow the powers in the region, the natural powers in the region, to emerge as the natural powers that they are, for us to have constructive strategic relations with each of them and have them balance amongst themselves, so that it's not just us versus whatever power is on the ground. It means that we're not constantly in a situation where we have to try to take out the emerging big power, whether it's Iraq or Iran or now even Libya, where we're not in a position to have to always try to take out the challenger to the pro-American political order. There's an order on the ground that is balancing amongst itself, where the powers are balancing amongst themselves. To me, that is the real great challenge in our diplomacy, to allow these powers to emerge, us to have a strategic relationship with each of them, and for them to balance amongst themselves. One more. I think it actually is principally about Iran, and principally about, although President Obama puts forward this very bold and I think critically important concept of strategic engagement with the Islamic Republic of Iran, he eventually dismisses that, ditches it, throws it away after the elections there in June 2009, and essentially does with what he did with Libya, with Gaddafi, but he doesn't say it explicitly, but essentially does the same thing, that can't negotiate with them. That regime is just, it's just a question of when it's gonna go, it's got to go. And so all the negotiations that we've had with them, I think are just going through the motions as we're on this slow trajectory towards conflict with the Islamic Republic of Iran. So I think it's about not wanting to have an effective agreement with them at this point. And it's one of the, it ends up being very distorting in the politics and the actual tactics of what goes on, so distorting that it becomes even dishonest at times. So just a month before, I think 3 weeks or a month before, the Turkish and Brazilian heads of state go to Iran to negotiate this agreement. President Obama writes a letter to them, both to Lula in Brazil and to Erdogan in Turkey, where he, you know, he basically says it's going to be very difficult to negotiate with the Iranians, but, you know, if you need to do that, these are the things that have to be in the agreement. He spells them out, 1, 2, 3, very clearly, very explicitly. Lo and behold, Lula and Erdogan take that letter, they go, you know, buy the letter of that letter, and they negotiate an agreement that includes everything that President Obama laid out in the letter. They get the agreement. What happens? The Obama administration is put in the ridiculous position of having to say that a letter from the President of the United States doesn't represent US policy. It's a ridiculous position, if not outright dishonest. And I think you end up being that way, not because people are bad people in the White House, not because they're naturally dishonest, but because the process has now become so distorting, because it's really about designating Iran, just as we've designated Libya, as an outlier state that cannot be part of a pro-American political and security order, and it has to do with our consideration at this point of their internal politics. We're not saying it as explicitly on Iran because there's much more at stake with Iran. We're saying it explicitly with Libya, but I think it's the same thing that's at stake. And we will continue to see this kind of distortion in the politics bordering on the dishonest.